Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're off. It started. Fan Mail, Fan Club, not Fan Mail. That's a different show. That is a show about, I'm not going to even bother.
if the whole show was just us reading out our correspondence, it probably wouldn't be so long. I think we do all of it, don't we? So there's a very good chance.
Did we talk about last week, Nathaniel?
What did we talk about? I don't know. Just deleted it.
We talked about positive thinking.
This is, I suppose not.
Do you know what? This is your idea of positive thinking. Do you know what? If we did a show, I bet if we did a show called Fan Mail and we just read out our fan mail, it would be a minute long. And that would include introducing stuff. That's you, that is.
It is. Right? I mean,
If I was to do it with my positive thinking mentality, I'd go, if we were to do a show called Fan Mail, it would be live streaming the news. It would like be never a live ending. Feed. Never ending. We'd have to take night shifts. Yeah, we wouldn't hang out at all. We might have like an hour. We'd have 2 hours a day where I would sort of like, we'd have a handover hour. And then, you know, we'd basically be like this, I suppose, but split up. So I would do 12 till 12 and you'd do 12 till 12. Is that how it works?
Day, isn't it? Yeah, it's a long day though still, isn't it? Big. Do you remember about 5 or 6 years ago, Ringo Starr had to announce that he could no longer accept fan mail because he had too much?
I think that was longer than 5 or 6 years ago, wasn't it? Oh, no, wasn't there? There's a joke in The Simpsons in there where he's individually replying to everyone's fan mail. This is Simpsons in the 90s, where Ringo Starr is individually replying to every... This is Simpsons in the 90s, where the Beatles had only been split up for 20 years.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
25 years. I'm sorry, Lisa, but I won't be able to answer your fan mail today because I have far too many. Can you please, all of you, please, can you please stop writing fan mail? All right? I'm a very busy man and I just don't have time to get around to answering all your fan mail, all right? I mean, I appreciate the support after all these years. You know, we're all big fans of the Magic Christian. Peace and love, peace and love. But I'm just saying, I don't have to, it's like that.
Yeah, no, he was trying to do it, and he said at one point, I think, I'm warning you that I'm not going to reply. But again, then he said, I'm warning you with peace and love. And he was like, it's like a weird phrase. I'm going to warn you with peace and love. I'm not.
I'm warning you with peace and love that I won't be responding to any more of your fan mail. Is that him? That's not bad. That's pretty good. Yeah, well, tell your fucking face, mate, because here I am, you know, pulling a fucking Ringo Starr impression out of my arse, and you're just staring at me like, oh, God, this will come out in the edit.
I saw the Magic Christian again last week.
Last week? Hang on a minute.
Oh, it's not in the edit.
Hang on a minute.
Yeah.
You saw
the
Magic Christian
last
week.
Yeah.
How often is the Magic Christian ever mentioned on a week-by-week basis in your life?
Very rarely, but you got to remember, Nick, that's fan club. Different rules apply.
Yes, we're through the looking glass here, people. We're through the looking glass here, people. Very much like Ash in Evil Dead 2, as he stares into his possessed face through the mirror, which was actually a pool of water that was shot flat on the ground. And Bruce Campbell was suspended. Whose birthday it was yesterday? He was suspended above it. Fucking hell! You're listening to Fan Club. First rule of Fan Club.
Tell your friends.
Second rule of Fan Club.
Please, for the love of God, tell your friends.
Tell your friends about Fan Club. I'm in I've come back to visit my parents for Father's Day, and then I was and they wanted me to empty my childhood bedroom, just get rid of everything, because I think they've been trapped in a house for 2 years, a year and a half, and they just haven't been able to access one of the rooms. And I imagine during a pandemic, just having a little bit more space would have been very helpful. But so I'm here now, and I'm trying to sort it, but it didn't occur to me that I've got all of my meetings, my laptop doesn't work very well, and all of my meetings are basically essentially on Zoom and online, and I have to do it through my phone. So I can't access any of my notes. I can't access any messages that anyone might have. Normally, Natalie sort of like helps us through the 2 hours by letting us know. Because we do it as live, don't we, Nat?
We do it as live.
So this week is going to be an absolute, well, Nathaniel, so brace yourselves, guys, because Nathaniel is in charge of timekeeping, he's in charge of reading out the fan mail, all of the stuff that you've come to know and love is now in, well, I'm going to say with heavy, inverted commas, capable hands, you know, read into that what you will, a heavy dose of irony laced throughout it, very capable hands of Nathaniel. I'm in my sister's bedroom, and I wasn't allowed in there better times, let alone take it over as a broadcasting unit. So it might be a little bit different today. We've got an amazing guest, we're just going to make the best out of a bad situation, basically. Anyway, Nathaniel's
They wouldn't
in
have known. They wouldn't have known had you said that. It's going to be
They're
so.
They're going to know.
It's going to be so slick, Nick, that no one's going to notice any difference whatsoever.
That'll be their first giveaway, then, won't it? It'll be what's gone on. I hope it isn't like this forever. Don't worry, guys. It won't be. I'll be back next week. We're in the very incapable hands of Nathaniel. Anyway, right, okay. So when I was at university, we used to have a video shop called MVC. And it was sort of like HMV, but it was MVC. It was genius. And they sold DVDs, CDs, VHS probably, because it was fucking ages ago.
So it's MVC Music, Video and something else? And
CDs or music video and cassettes?
Maybe something like that, yeah.
Maybe something like that. It was an HMV, but it was MVC. And what you'd do is you'd get like an MVC card, which was like a credit card, and you'd get like money off. And it was dirt cheap. And I would basically, when I was in Winchester, I would go in to MVC every week, and I would kind of like buy a load of stuff. And one of the things I bought was a film called The Magic Christian that starred Peter Sellers and Ringo Starr. And when was it made? 1970? I'm going to guess 1972.
I think it's 69, I think.
Right, so it was like Ringo
Actually, it must going... be later than that. Must be later than that, right? Because that would be at the time of the Beatles. Although it has got a Paul McCartney soundtrack. So it must be when they're all on good terms.
I don't think that when the Beatles split up, they fell out. Paul McCartney played on Ringo's solo albums.
Yeah, you're right, 69.
And I think you said 69, I said 72.
Oh. Well,
so there's already, yeah, I know, but it's like it's already fallen apart. It's not too late for me to just put a pause on this, get on a train, come back to London, record the series. They could record the episodes and then get on a train and come back. If you want, we'll have a safety. Do you know what, Nat? We'll have a safety word. What'll it be? What will our safety word be? It'll be, it's got to be something you're comfortable with.
And it's got to be something we wouldn't automatically say normally.
Yeah.
Natalie suggested Malta. Does that mean we're not going to mention Malta because we're out the charts? Is that what's happened, Natalie?
Hang on.
Yes, we're not in the Maltese charts.
We're not in the Maltese charts. We're not in the Maltese charts.
Are we in the New Zealand charts again? Or have we dropped out of New Zealand? Natalie's going to be looking that up. No charts this week, says Natalie. No charts, or we're not in the charts.
Do you mean we? Yeah. Do you mean that we haven't charted this week?
Or you haven't checked the charts this week?
Or you haven't checked, because that's two very different things. You're not charting this week. Do you know why that is? It's because I think, and it can only be this, you're getting your chart data a week late, and we didn't do a show the week before last.
Yes. That must be how it works.
That's how iPods. That's how, what do we do?
Podcasts. iTunes.
That's how iTunes-y podcasts work, isn't it? It's you can only listen to them the week they can. I'm going to go out on a limb here, Matt. And I'm not blaming it all on you, but I think this is the worst show we've done. Started badly, and it got worse.
Do you know what? Historically, I can't believe it's the worst one. You think about it, I think there's been worse ones than this.
It's a show of two halves, isn't it? I think that we might have chatted about that off air.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, but we're just warming up, aren't we? Anyway. 1969. So I think that, Paul McCartney had Paul McCartney was the Beatles by 1969. Lennon had checked out.
Yeah.
George Harrison was miserable. And Ringo, who, although he was a competent and sometimes great drummer, wasn't the greatest musician of them all. And he had his sights set on being a movie star. Hmm. He even wrote a song about it, didn't he?
Yeah.
Act Naturally.
Yes, yes.
No, I'm just saying it, weird. You're being all weird, Nat.
I thought you were setting it up.
What's the name of the Ringo song? What's the name of the Ringo song then?
No, I thought you were going to do a switcheroo.
Octopus's Garden.
Yeah. That's what I was waiting for.
So, of course, John Lennon had checked out. George Harrison was miserable. Paul McCartney was the Beatles. And although he was a competent and sometimes great drummer, Ringo had his eyes sighted on being a movie star. He even wrote a song about it, didn't he?
He did.
Thomas the Tank Engine.
Yes! Even better. Now we're back, we're cooking. This is what you've come to expect. Top draw, improvised comedy.
How absurd. How absurd, or as Nathaniel might say, absurd. Now...
Do I say that?
Yeah, it's weird.
Do I say absurd?
Yes.
I know you say often pronounce V's as F's. I say ferry rather than very.
Yeah, that's like the musician Brian Ferry. You say absurd, but also I wonder. I'm going to write a word down, and I want you to say it out loud.
Right. This is going to be like brilliant.
It's that background. That's backwards, isn't it?
No, right. I can see it. That says greasy.
Oh, interesting.
Did you think I was going to say greasy?
Yeah, what's that about?
Greasy. I think maybe I do sometimes say greasy.
I don't know if you do, but people do.
People do, for sure.
And what's the other one? It's when people say stuff like sexual, and they say sexual.
Sexual. And it's like, oh, yeah, I don't like that.
And it makes it, but they don't say sexual and they don't say sexual. They say sexual.
Sexual. Yeah, I've heard that. God,
ironically, it shrivels my nuts. but there you go. So Ringo teamed up with Peter Sellers, and they made this weird film called The Magic Christian, which I got on VHS. I watched it once. It's sort of like a 1960s farcical Prince and the Pauper type comedy. And I guess it had lots of guest stars at the time. This is just off memory. Had loads of guest stars at the time. I've barely thought of it since, until today when I mentioned it to you, and then it turns out that you watched it last week. Now that That is fan club, but that is also fucking mental. So tell us, Nathaniel, if there's anyone out there, what, where did you watch it? How did you see it? Have you seen it before? What did you think?
I think this is the second time I've watched it. And I remember watching it and being a bit, oh, it's like one of those mad 60s movies. But then since I watched it, I'd heard people talk about it as if it's like one of the worst films ever. And I've always been a bit like, see, I quite liked it. I mean, I think it's one of those proper movies that only really existed in the time. What it's most like, really, it's a sketch movie with a really sort of vague plot put on top of it. Where it's Peter, so it's written by Cleese and Chapman, I think, John Cleese and Graham Chapman. And it feels like when you watch it, it's like a sketch movie.
So this was what, during, after, when was Monty Python?
It'd be about the same time, wouldn't it? Yeah, probably so about Monty exactly Python, the same time.
But how does Monty Python work? Monty Python was 60s, was it? 60s,
yeah,
early 70s?
It started 70s? Late 60s.
And they did a series, the last series of Monty Python was without John Cleese, and it wasn't as big a success. And they made what, not only, but also was sort of like, they refilmed their best sketches on film and released them in American cinemas.
Now for something completely different, that was. So
well,
that's,
what's not only, but also, that's...
That's Peter Cook, Dudley Moore.
Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. So they did now something completely different, which was a sketch movie where they refilmed their best sketches, which must be a fucking nightmare if you think about it, because it's like lightning. It's like, you know, capturing lightning in a bottle. And then they, but so when was Holy Grail? That must have been like what?
No, that's like what, mid 70s, 75. I think,
was it that, or was it 78? When was Life of Brian?
Life of Brian 79, I'm pretty sure.
Life of Brian 79? Who produced Life of Brian then?
George Harrison.
George Harrison?
That's fan club.
They were all fucking... fucking.
They're all fucking.
I mean, it was all some sort of British export.
It was. They're all just paddy, weren't they?
Yeah, it was just a massive fuckfest, yeah.
75, says Natalie, for Holy Grail. 75 and 79 for the two big Monty Python movies.
And then when was Meaning of Life then?
83, I reckon. 83! 83, says Natalie.
What you find when you watch Meaning of Life is how incredibly slick it looks. Like, the special effects are incredible in Meaning of Life. And I would say that Meaning of Life is my favourite of the three. And then it would be Life of Brian. And then it would be Holy Grail. And I don't think I've seen them. I haven't seen it all. Okay, right. So Graham Chapman, John Cleese, off the height of... and do you know what? I guess this is sort of what the show is. If you're a first-time listener, why are you starting with this one? Well, I know why you'd be starting with this one.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, so...
skip ahead to an hour, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing... Guys, there's nothing here for you. Skip ahead. So if you're a first-time listener, guess what the show is? Is that we will do no prep. Nathaniel will say something that he's watched. I'll take over the conversation for a good 50 minutes. Mm-hmm. Then Nathaniel will chip in every so often. And right at the end, he'll be able to, by the way, send you a fan mail into the fan club at foodbarradio.com. I'm not getting your messages, guys, but what I am, I'm talking to the team now. What I am doing is they're popping up at the bottom of the screen. So
just for a second, are you getting them?
Yeah, it just pops up and then it goes back down again.
Oh, that's all right.
So what will happen is that Nathaniel will say that he's seen a film, and then, with absolutely no research or resources, me and Nathaniel will clumsily feel our way through the time and the cast and the...
Well, you say I think you're putting a negative spin on it, whereas I think we clumsily do it, but I say we impressively do it. Given that we're basically conjuring up memories from the past of stuff we've learnt fairly accurately, I'd say, date-wise and plot-wise.
I'm going to say something. I'm going to be honest on this show for the first time, all right? It's been 3.5 years. I'm going to drop the mask and I'm going to say it hasn't been 3.5 years. That's a lie for a start. I'm going to drop the pretense, right? And I'm going to finally say what it is. You know, magic doesn't exist. Yeah. Right. That doesn't mean that's not a bad thing, but real magic doesn't exactly exist. You know, you watch your David Copperfield, and he's planned that out. Right, to the nth degree, yeah. And Darren Brown, it's all kind of like mind tricks and confidence tricks, and it's not actual wizarding, yeah. He might call himself a wizard, but I don't think that Darren Brown is an actual wizard. But what I would say is, some of the stuff that we've pulled out of the bag on Fan Club. If magic doesn't exist, this is as close as it gets. I mean, that's telepathy, right? That's telepathy. For you, before we started, you were going to say, oh, now what have I? I'm just going to call it out at the moment because I think that people take it for granted a little bit what happens here. And in actual fact, before we started, you said, oh, gosh, what have I seen this week? And you made a list. I didn't know. And I meant, and then I meant, I cannot believe the magic critic. And we haven't looked it up on IMDb, but we've done nothing.
No.
This is as live on air. And we've got like pretty much everything right so far.
Also, I'd say another example of this, which will probably impress some of our new listeners. In fact, maybe I shouldn't tell that story, or maybe I'll tell it later on. Maybe it's better.
You can tease. You can. Why is it give away the guest, or does it tease?
Sort of tease the guest.
We never normally mention the guest, do we? Nah. And then, but we're very excited about it.
I'm very aware of our new listeners who might do, because we were said that me and Nick Helm, I'd say, are not usually. We wouldn't describe ourselves as Star Trek fans in the traditional. Sense, or like the way you would imagine, if you're a Star Trek fan, you know everything about Star Trek. Like, and I would say I don't know everything about Star Trek by any means.
I like some of the catchphrases that they have. Nanu, nanu.
Yeah, that's one of my faves.
What did Roy Scheider used to say in Sequest DS3? He used to say something like, "Oh, I better take the plunge, I guess." That was Star Trek, wasn't it?
That is it. I think that was the 90s one, wasn't it? The one they did in the
90s. That was 90s Star Trek.
Yeah.
Sequest DSV.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But
I was impressed where I was around your house last week before, and I was impressed that we were talking about all the Star Trek films, one of which I don't think – maybe I've definitely never seen. I don't know if you had seen it. And you recognised it was from,
no,
based on.
No, you'll miss. Oh right, you are sort of mistelling this. We saw a clip.
That's right.
So what happened? There's this awful clip online of William Shatner introducing the original cast of Star Trek on a stage, and
it feels like it's promo, doesn't it? It's like the first day of filming or something.
It's like a press launch. It's like, I think that they've probably made the film, or they're just about, yeah, you're right. Maybe they're launching the film and they've got all the press there and they've all come out in their costumes.
And they've built and behind like a stage, the bridge of the sort of movie era Starship Enterprise, haven't they?
Do you know what I think it is? I think it's probably an anniversary that they're celebrating, some sort of Star Trek anniversary. Although the next Star Trek film, I think, was the anniversary one, so I'm not sure. And William Shatner goes around and he introduces all of the cast members. And then he gets Walter Koenig and, is that his name?
Yeah.
He gets to Walter Koenig and he blanks. So who played Uhura?
Nichelle Nichols,
right, okay. So he goes, here's Nichelle Nichols, here's fucking Leonard Nimoy.
Here's
James Doohan.
James Doohan. Jimmy Doohan.
Here's Jimmy Doohan. Here's Nichelle Nichols. Here's DeForest Kelly. Here's George Takei. He even gets George Takei's name wrong, and they hated each other, so this is particularly insulting. And then he gets to Walter Koenig, and he goes, and here's the gentleman that played Chekhov. And Walter Koenig just snaps. He goes, Walter Koenig!
And I said to you, God, this is mental, because at this point, how long must they have been working together? Then we realised we didn't know the date that the clip had happened. But essentially, you devised from.
Well, there's no information on the clip. Hang on, there's one bit of information, Hang on, that we're missing here. He went around everyone. Interesting. He did the thing. All right. And then you said when, so he'd worked with Walter Koenig. He wasn't in the first season, Walter Koenig, but he was in. He was introduced to Chekhov in the second season, and I think it ran for three seasons. And so they'd worked together. But it's not just the working together. It's all of the years of conventions that they'd had in between.
Yeah.
The fact that it's the most famous thing that William Shatner has ever done. And he is tied to all of those other characters on merchandising. Just like if you see a picture of Shatner, you're only three or four people away from Chekhov. And... So there's all that, and then what was the other thing I was going to say?
And also,
judging by the way they looked, they'd made a few films together, so they've been on film sets together as well. And you said, "Gore, they must have been working together."
So I was guessing, about 20 years at this point, and then we realised we were going. But when is this clip from? What era is this clip from? And it looks like it's definitely from the movie era at some point. And you looked at Nichelle Nichols' hair, was it, and how what shade of grey it was. And you said, I think this is Star Trek V, and that's 19. And I said, what's that, 1990? And you said, 89. And we looked it up, and it was all from Star Trek V from 1989.
Neither of us have seen it.
No, neither of us have seen the film.
I've seen Star Trek. I saw Star Trek 1, the first Star Trek film, last year. All the way through for the first time. I've seen bits of it, but all the way through for the first time, I was just like, do you know what? You're 39. I was 39 last year. You're 39. It's time to grow up. You can't do 2001 A Space Odyssey, but you can do the next best thing. You can do Star Trek, the motion picture, all right? And because, I've never been able to get through 2001, and I've never been able to get through Star Trek, the motion picture. So I watched Star Trek, the motion picture, watched it, and I was like, fine, I've done that. So I've seen that one once. I've seen Wrath of Khan a few times. I've seen Star Trek 3 a few times. I've seen Star Trek 4, the most times, and I love that, and Star Trek 6 over and over and over and over again. Love that. Every time it's on TV, when Christopher Plummer died, Star Trek 6 is basically the film that Hunt Red October wishes it was. It's just, it's incredible. And I've just never really wanted to watch Star Trek 5. So if you're a first-time listener, don't worry. we've seen them. We've seen a few of them.
Yeah. Could you do that? Could you name the date of a bit of film how grey Nichelle Nichols' hair was?
Can you find a random clip on YouTube and then put a date to it based on Nichelle Nichols' hair? Well, basically, she dyed her hair black for all the other films, and in Star Trek V, she had grey hair. And so it's actually quite easy. They're doing a thing, and she's got grey hair, and you go, well, she had grey hair in Star Trek V, didn't she? I haven't seen it, but I've seen pictures of it. I've seen clips of it. You know, I'm not crazy.
What year it came out.
I know what year it is. Well, of course it is, because Star Trek VI was 1990, what, 92, 91?
Yeah.
And Star Trek 4 would have been 86, because 86, 87, I went to the cinema to see that. My mum took me to the cinema to see that. So there you go. Anyway, we've done half an hour.
I was going to say, we've done half an hour. Yeah, I didn't need it to tell me. So shall we play a song?
Yeah, just in the nick of time, Natalie has told us to play Alice soon. We're doing it.
We're doing it now.
Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
Ah, we're back. Yes, it was 1991 was Star Trek 6. Not 1981, as some members of the team misheard.
Wasn't me.
Which should be impossible. All right, okay. So that's basically it. We're just pulling magic out of our asses every week, and it's impressive. So if you haven't got that, then you should maybe correct the way
thought
that
processes. If you're reviewing this in your head poorly, you need to readdress that review and go, Actually, I forget, this is a 5-star show. Give
it's
us a review. Pop it in the
star.
iTunes.
5-star family fun size fan club. It's you've got to adjust that. You know, you've got to tweak it slightly in your mind and go, oh, actually, this show's great, and it is. So, but you'll be mistaken for thinking it's shit. There's no other show on the planet, I suppose, that is quite like this.
Yeah, there's no other show that you can listen to today. You can check BBC Sounds in the search bar. You go, oh, well, I like the film The Magic Christian, and I like Star Trek V. Any of those things that could be covered in the same show? You won't find one.
You won't find one, especially not in 2021.
No, certainly not.
And it's all, Billie Eilish.
Billie Eilish and Big Nasty. That's what they talk about now. They're the two big topics.
Which is a shame, really, because it means that Star Trek V isn't really getting a look in anymore. But it should. Well, it's had its time on this show. Anyway.
And we've not seen it, just to be clear.
Just to be clear, we filled up 15 minutes of airtime with talking about film the rest of the scene.
Sure.
But I've as good as seen it. I mean, it was directed by William Shatner. It was made in 1999. It was a contractual thing where... if there was if Leonard Nimoy got to direct a film, then he would get to direct a film. Leonard Nimoy directed Star Trek III, taking over from Nicholas Meyer, who directed the first one, and Robert Wise, who directed the first one.
Why did Leonard Nimoy direct the third one, Nick?
I think because they wanted to bring back Spock. I think the fact that Spock died in Wrath of Khan, spoiler alert, Spock dies in Wrath of Khan, what's, I think, uniquely great about we're talking about the original series now, it's not a complete spoiler. We're talking about the original series now, so it's got nothing to do with our cast that's coming up later. Is that it's a series that failed, and then they, well, maybe it didn't quite fail, but it didn't make enough of a profit to sort of like compete with something like Star Wars. So basically, 20th Century Fox made Star Wars. It was a huge hit. No one saw it coming. No one thought it would happen. And then all the other production companies scrambled around to kind of like look through their stuff and go, well, what have we got? Disney made The Black Hole. MGM made Moonraker. And, James Bond turned into like a... If you look at... what was the film before Moonraker?
Is it The Spy Who Loved Me, maybe? Sort of around that was, sort of time.
And what was the film after Moonraker? For Your Eyes Only?
Yeah, For Your Eyes Only, probably, yeah. Your Eyes Only.
So at the end of, what did you just say, The Spy Who Loved Me?
Yeah.
At the end of whatever it was, I'm not sure if it was The Spy Who Loved Me, it says James Bond will return in For Your Eyes Only. And then Star Wars came out and they were like, fuck. So they bumped that. And they brought out Moonraker instead, which is based on a James Bond's book in name only. So everyone was scrambling around, and Paramount were like, oh, we've got Star Trek, which was a failed, cancelled TV series. Mm. And, Shatner was he doing TJ Hooker by then? And so then they just brought everyone out of retirement, and they made Robert Wise, who'd done sort of like, disaster movies and musicals and stuff. He also did classic Hollywood.
Day the Earth Stood Still, didn't he? So it was a big sort of 50s sci-fi movie. So I guess he was a kind of, oh, we'll get that guy who did that big sci-fi movie from years ago.
So he was like a classic Hollywood movie director. They got him in and they just made this incredibly slow moving. And one of the recurring things that you get with cast members and directors and the people that get involved in Star Trek is that they weren't fans of the series and they'd never seen it. Mm. And so Robert Wise came in and he directed it and it wasn't very good. And then they were like, well, what do we do with Star Trek? We'll give it another chance. And they brought Nicholas Meyer in and he wrote it and directed it. And he made it into this sort of low budget thriller.
Yeah, that was it. They weren't sure whether they were going to do a sequel to it, but they realized they kind of didn't have enough movies out that year. So they were like, oh, should we do another Star Trek? And they were like, I'm not putting any money into it. It didn't make enough money. So they sort of did it almost like on a sort of bumped up sort of TV budget, didn't they? They sort of thought, well, let's do it as like a low budget sequel. So Star Trek 2 has no money, I think, behind it.
And what they do is it's low budget, lower budget. It's still got special effects and stuff, but it's lower budget. And Star Trek fans, rate it as the best Star Trek film. But also, Yeah, but also they were kind of like, well, one of the problems with the first film was there wasn't really a bad guy. So let's get a bad guy. And they were like, who can we get? And then they rewatched. I think he's in the first season, because Chekhov's not in the first season, but he is in the film. So they get Khan from the first season, who they abandon on a planet. And they say, well, he's just spent the last 15 years plotting his revenge on Captain Kirk, and that's the plot of Star Trek 2. Star Trek 2 came out in before 1999, the best year of cinema, along with films such as E.T. and Poltergeist. And it held its own, and it did really well. And what's interesting about Star Trek 2 is it's the second film in the middle of a 6/7-part series of films with the original crew of the Starship Enterprise. But it kicks off a trilogy within a series. So Star Trek 2, 3 and 4 are a mini sort of like self-contained trilogy within the 6/7 Star Trek movies featuring Captain Kirk. So Nicholas Meyer made the third one, and Spock dies at the end, and Leonard Nimoy was like, come on, let's put an end to this. I want to direct Three Men and a Baby. And it sort of like did badly with test screening, so they were like, okay, let's film an extra shot at the end where we see Spock's casket on a planet that's just been rebooted by the Genesis Project, which is like a terraforming missile that brings dead planets back to life. And he gets caught up in all of that, doesn't he, Spock, knowing him? And then Star Trek 3 doesn't really feature Spock that much until way towards the end. Or it's like a child Spock, so it's not Leonard Nimoy. And Leonard Nimoy was like, well, I'll come back if you let me direct it. So he directed the third one. And the third one was kind of like, it didn't really feature Spock. It was kind of a bit plodding. It's got Christopher Lloyd in it as the bad Klingon. As the evil Klingon in it, and there's some really good bits in it, but it is kind of a bit of a dull one. And then I think again, in a budget saving thing, they were like, well, when we do the fourth one, let's set it in present day San Francisco. And it was originally meant to be a crossover between Star Trek and Eddie Murphy, because Eddie Murphy was a big Star Trek fan. And so they Paramount owned Beverly Hills Cop and Star Trek, and was just like, okay, we'll do it like this. Eddie Murphy was a huge star, and it was going to be a bit like Superman 3 with Richard Pryor, and then Eddie Murphy dropped out for some reason, and Leonard Nimoy directed that, which was a very broad, likeable, family-friendly, audience-friendly comedy, which almost requires no prior knowledge to any of the Star Trek films. It's sort of a standalone, but it also finishes off this three-part trilogy where they lose the Enterprise and then they try and get the Enterprise back, and then by the end of the fourth Star Trek film, they've got the thing. And so Leonard Nimoy did one that wasn't so, Star Trek 2, huge hit. Star Trek 3, not quite as big as a hit. Well, we'll give you a smaller budget with Star Trek 4. Star Trek 4 was an absolute banger. And then William Shatner was like, I doubt William Shatner saw the results of Star Trek 3 and was just like, I want to do one of these. But when Star Trek 4 was a huge hit, Shatner was like, oh, do you know what? It's in my contract that says that if he does one, I can do one. So William Shatner did Star Trek 5. And while they were making it, the budgets got slashed. And he basically, for all of the things that, that people say about Shatner and his ego and all of this stuff, I think that really he had a really good film in him, and they slashed all the budget, and it kind of like got taken out of his control to some degree. I love him. And then, so Star Trek 5 wasn't a big hit, and then they were just like, right, well, that's it. We'll reboot the series. And then it came up to sort of like, this is an anniversary year. I think 91 was maybe an anniversary year or something like that. And so they were like, well, let's just end it all in style. And they did, and they made probably the best one. I think Star Trek 4 is my favourite, because that's the one I saw at the cinema, and that's what I grew up with. And it's also almost like the least Star Trek-y one. It's all character comedy. Basically, it's just a cast of people that you absolutely love. They all get standout moments. They've sort of like, through osmosis, permeated your life. And then you just see them go on like a fun adventure. They were like also, after the third one being quite dry and serious, the fourth one had to be really light and silly. And there was, you know, and they did that with all of the Star Trek films. They all kind of have a different tone to them. And so with the sixth one, they were just like, okay, well, let's do like a serious Star Trek film where we'll sort of like use the Berlin Wall and Russia and America, and we use that as a metaphor for Starfleet and Klingons. And they did like a very contemporary kind of like story about the end of the Cold War. And they were like, well, if this is the end of the Cold War, it's the end of an era. The Russians aren't our enemies anymore. What's the future for Star Trek? If, you know, what would the future for Star Trek be if the Klingons became friends with the Federation? Which sort of, I think Next Generation had already started on TV by then. And so it's sort of, and there was a Klingon crew member in Worf, played by Michael Dorn. Mm-hmm. And so I think Star Trek Next Generation started in 87. And they used to use the set to do the film. So they used the set from Next Generation for the film Star Trek 5, and I guess they adapted it for Star Trek 6. So they were like running at the same time. Michael Dorn's got a cameo in Star Trek 6 as Worf's ancestor. And and they were just like, this is sort of like a perfect time to end the original series. Mm-hmm.
So that was very much the idea of it, wasn't it? Like when it came out, they were like, this is like the last one. We're not doing any more after this. And it was sort of seen as a bit of a last hurrah, wasn't it?
Like, they all signed their names at the end. They signed their names on the end credits. I don't think you could do it any better. I mean, based on the budgetary restraints that they had, and the special effects of the era, I mean, they were really like pushing the boundaries of what they could do. It's like the CGI in it.
Oh yeah, it really looks good, that film. It's a really good looking film, and I think some of the others aren't as good looking as that. I think it's a really like, it's like a surprisingly good film. I remember going to see it with a kind of not a huge amount of like oh yeah, sure, I'll see the new Star Trek film, but I remember being really impressed and really liking it. And it's like a murder mystery as well, isn't it? So it sort of works. It works on its own. It is like a Cold War thriller that they've just adapted. It's quite standalone. It feels like you get it. You get what type of film it is. The effects are impressive. It all looks good. It all signs off. And essentially, it kind of works as a last film because what they've done is they've given them a really good one. So they've gone, we'll just make a really good one. We'll make a proper film, and that'll be like the end of Star Trek.
And they got Nicholas Meyer back to do it, who wrote Star Trek 4, I think. But he was so upset by the fact that they brought Spock back. He didn't. That's the reason why Nimoy did 3. They offered it to Nicholas Meyer, and he was just like, I killed him off. How can you bring him back straight away? It's cheap. So they got Nimoy to do it because he knew it so well. He knew the material. But Nicholas Meyer came back for the sixth one, and he wrote the fourth one, so he's sort of like involved in all of the best ones. But again, not seen all of them, and not what did I say the other day? I said, the thing is, Nat, we don't love anything, we just like everything a bit.
Yeah.
that's kind of it. But I would say that I love some of the Star Trek films a lot. But anyway, so Magic Christian, that's what we were talking about.
That's right, the Magic Christian.
Because I've got to talk about what I've seen this week.
What have you seen this week, Nick?
We're doing the Magic Christian. We've just got to do it. What did you think? Is it awful?
I think this is my second time watching it. And I like it. It's a really, like, I mean, there's definitely lots of problems with it. And I think if you don't like it, I mean, people don't like films that don't have a kind of really obvious linear narrative, I think. And a film like that is not interested in telling a story. It's interested in being like a sort of satire. A lot of that satire doesn't work now, and a lot of it is dated. But I think for what it's trying to do, it's quite successful. And it's really fun as well. I think it's a really fun seeing people pop up for a moment. And
so what is it? It's like, so it's Peter Sellers plays a millionaire.
He's like a millionaire and very much of the upper class in England.
He's got a floppy wig and he wears a fur coat and he drives a limo, like a stretch limo. And Ringo Starr plays what? An orphaned 40-year-old.
He's like a homeless man who, in the basically the first scene, is Peter Sellers walks up to Ringo Starr, who's a homeless man who I think is living in sort of around Parliament in Westminster, and says hello. And rather than offering him money, says, "Would you like to be my son?" Ringo Starr says, "Yes, please," and is then adopted by Peter Sellers as Peter Sellers' adopted son. So Ringo Starr is basically a homeless man who is adopted by a member of the aristocracy. And Peter Sellers' character in it is both a member of the aristocracy and part of it, but is also trying to subvert lots of things about the British establishment. So what follows is essentially a series of sketches that are basically a sort of satire on various different elements of British life, and with lots and lots of sort of guest stars from the period.
Now what I'm going to say here is we're 50 minutes in and you have only just said the plot of The Magic Christian.
To be fair, we've spoken a lot about Star Trek and that wasn't all me.
It was a tiny little what am I saying? It was a tiny little...
No more than 2 or 3 minutes on Star Trek we did in the middle.
I barely remember mentioning it, to be fair. I just remember you banging on about The Magic Christian. I think that when we're talking about obscure stuff, and I should probably do this off air, but I'm going to do it on air so that everyone knows that, you know, A, I want everyone to know, I am bringing it up with you, and I want to be transparent about this, but also
you want it on record.
I want it on record, but also B, I'm certainly, as soon as the time runs out and we've finished, I'm not going to put any more thought into this show. So I'm doubling up. We're having kind of like, we're having like a production meeting at the same time as actually doing the show. So what I'll say is that next time you talk about something as obscure as The Magic Christian, yeah, it's a given. I'll know what it is. I mean, I brought it up. You ran with it, sure, but 50 minutes in, and we've only just found out what it's about. So what I would say is, in future, just your headline is Magic Christian, film where Peter Sellers adopts Ringo Starr. And okay, then everyone's on board. So name us a couple of the guest stars, just to wrap this up, because I don't know if our audience feel the same as
friend
me.
Friend of the show, Christopher Lee.
Christopher Lee.
Lots of, like, basically everyone from British comedy at the time. Spike
Benny
Milligan.
Hill?
No. Cleese and Chapman, as mentioned.
How did they get them, then?
They wrote the script and also appear in it.
See, these are good things to bring up. These are good things to bring up.
I did bring it up earlier. I said when it's a sketch movie. It's basically a sketch movie and they've got Cleese and Graham Chapman to write it. So it sort of makes sense, that kind of film. It's like a sort of Python-esque sort of, and I guess it's Peter Sellers doing a bit like, oh yeah, I'll get a bit of goons going in there. We'll get Milligan in there. Well, he is in it, Natalie, but I thought that might be I don't know if that was worth mentioning. He's a controversial figure in now.
Rather bizarrely, Natalie has said, oh, Roman Polanski is in it. Yeah, he is, yeah.
Yeah, he's also in it.
Sure, great. Why would you want us to...
Lots of people from the late 60s who were famous figures from the time.
Not enough people are championing Roman Polanski these days, so we want to get those... We want to mop up those Roman Polanski hits where people are kind of like, you know, those people that are on the fence, you know, they can still find out Roman Polanski information.
I like Roman Polanski, Star Trek V and The Magic Christian. Anything for me out there? That's what I want. Anything I can listen to?
That's fan club.
That's where we are. Fan club.
So, okay, right, The Magic Christian. Yeah, I don't think I will. But like, this is also a time when Peter Sellers was kind of like struggling, wasn't he? And he didn't really know.
Yeah, it's hard to know whether he's really putting his star into something. Because on one hand, it feels a bit like, is he sort of supporting kind of new people? Or is he kind of really desperately searching for a vehicle he can...
I don't know if he's desperately searching for a vehicle, but he is searching for a vehicle. And I think it's mutually beneficial, isn't it? If you're like an older comedy star.
Yeah. Also, with
things to associate yourself with the new guys.
Yeah. But when you watch stuff like Hard Day's Night, it's very obvious that Peter Sellers could watch that and go, these guys are big fans of like the Goons and stuff. Very like, yeah. He's obviously like, these guys are my guys. I've got a bit of sway with these guys.
Well, also with Help, and Ringo is kind of like the star of Help, like the film sort of, everyone's got a standout moment, but the whole plot revolves around Ringo. And he's the one that really wanted to, be the movie star. He wrote a song about it called The Magic Christian. So I'm trying to think of one other thing that Ringo started that was called the Simpsons episode where he gets fan mail.
Yeah. Do you do some fan mail, speaking of fan mail?
Well, I just want to say, because it's on iPlayer at the moment, that I watched the Sean Bean, Stephen Graham series Time. We were at home and we didn't feel like we could get through an entire film. So it was just like, what should we watch? And it looked kind of gritty. And weirdly, I just sort of assumed that their roles would be reversed, that it would be Stephen Graham as the criminal and Sean Bean as the warden, the prison officer. And it's the other way around. And, I think it's some of the best acting I've ever seen in film. Stephen Graham can do so much by, you know, seemingly doing very little, you know. And we were watching it and, you know, Stephen Graham will do absolutely nothing, but maybe he'll clench his jaw and it will completely change his demeanour and his thought process. And he's incredible. And Sean Bean, I've got nothing against Sean Bean whatsoever, but he has made a career of himself playing bad guys. You know, there's memes about he's the guy that dies in every single film that he's in, and he's sort of like the Hollywood. He's like the guy from Sheffield that made it in Hollywood. That's kind of, you know, 006 and GoldenEye, and he's the bad guy in Patriot Games, and he's like is it Boromir in Lord of the Rings?
Yeah, Ronin.
He's in Ronin, but Ronin's a weird film. I watched that on Sunday, and Ronin's a weird film where Sean Bean is in the first third and he gets disgraced and kicked out of the gang, and you just assume he's going to turn up in the last act as one of Jonathan Pryce's cronies, and like he's switched allegiances, and then he gets killed, doesn't ever appear in the film again, and you're kind of waiting. It's like the Bruce Campbell Congo effect, where you're waiting the whole film for Bruce Campbell to turn back up, and he doesn't.
Don't say a word. He was in that one, the Michael Douglas thriller. He's a baddie in that.
The Hitcher. He doesn't particularly deliver subtle performances. Not that he's bad in any way, but he doesn't. He's kind of like a big actor. You know, big Game of Thrones. What was that other film that was like Game of Thrones? Black Death. So he's sort of like this guy, and then. It reminded me of when Stallone is in that scene with De Niro in Copland, where you go, this is actually really special, where Stallone has really upped his game and goes head-to-head with De Niro in acting and just comes out of it great. Not like Grudge Match, where Stallone goes head-to-head with De Niro and just absolutely wipes the floor with him. And it says, oh, no, come on, Robert. You know, but it's weird, isn't it, that those two guys, a decade earlier, it was something that was absolutely magical. And then a decade later, you just like go, why are you doing this? But anyway, Sean Bean, the Hollywood guy, and Stephen Graham, the actor, just are both, everyone in it is phenomenal. The entire cast, the writing is great, the direction is great, like the whole thing is great. But I think it's one of the best things I've seen in terms of just quality and acting the whole way through. It was absolutely devastating and heartbreaking all the way through. But I haven't stopped thinking about it, and I think it's, you know, my mum doesn't want to see it because she says, oh, it looks too rough, you know, too sort of like sad. And yeah, it is, but it kind of, it's optimistic at the same time, slightly. Anyway, it was so good. If it's on iPlayer, watch it. Watch the fuck out. It's
brilliant. I've seen it too. I double recommend.
It's very rare, actually, that I was flicking through the TV. I've got no concept of what actual TV is. And I was flicking through the TV, and then Time came up and it was recommended. And it was on iPlayer, so I watched it on iPlayer. And little did I realise that it was only two episodes in on terrestrial TV. So I tweeted about it, because literally normally when something amazing comes on TV, everyone just takes over and starts talking about it. I thought it was actually, the fact that I hadn't seen anyone mention it, I thought was really odd, considering, like, how, I mean, it's, but I don't want to sound patronising or rude or anything, but like, Stephen Graham is just one of the greatest actors we've ever had. He's like one of the best exports. Like, when you see him in The Irishman, and you know, like, the story behind kind of like some of the scenes that he did with Al Pacino, where he kind of like knocks his ice cream on the floor and stuff like that. Like, he's sort of fearless, and you put yourself in. As an actor, put myself in his shoes, and you kind of like, I don't know, you know, Yeah, it's sort of awe-inspiring. I think he's just phenomenal. That is a given. In everything that he does, he's great. And then with Sean Bean, you're kind of like, well, like we said, when you look at something like Ronin, where he's up against De Niro, and he's kind of like got a very kind of like awkward character. The character that he's playing is awkward. But he also has some really awkward lines where he's talking about raspberry jam and stuff like that. And you kind of like go, yeah, great. To see him as good as he is, as an actor, as a very kind of like understated, small, contained performance.
And playing against Dyke, because he's a tough guy.
Absolutely.
He's a tough guy in films. Like, he's a tough guy. And in this, he's like an anti-tough guy. It's because when you say, like, oh, there's a new prison drama starting with Sean Bean, you go, mm-hmm. Oh, I get it. He's going to prison, and he's top dog, and he's,
yeah.
You know.
And I was writing the next episode as, you know, so you go, oh, right, so this is a slow burn thing. It's a very realistic take on a guy being pushed to his limits who finally snaps. And it's not that, and it's better for it.
Yeah,
you know, it's better, yeah, especially at the moment where kind of like the roles of masculinity are kind of being brought into question, and kind of like how relevant are like male archetypes and, you know, all of this stuff. And you kind of like watch Sean Bean and Stephen Graham in like a prison drama, and you go, isn't this sort of like a bit outdated? And you watch it, and it's kind of like, yeah, it absolutely plays against stereotypes, plays against types. And I just think it's so rich, it was just incredible.
And it was interesting that you do think of that thing when you think, oh, it's a sort of, it's not a two-hander at all, but they're the two main characters, and you've got a prison guard.
Well, they have scenes together, like changing over, but they don't have like meaty dialogue scenes together. It's not like, you know, the Sean and Stephen show. It's kind of like the Bean and Graham. It's kind of like they have like these parallel stories. And occasionally they bump into each other within the prison.
And it's so rare to see a story like that where essentially they're not bad guys. Sean Bean has done something, and that's it. It kind of takes that idea of crime and punishment, where Sean Bean has done something bad and he's being punished for it. But the sort of important part of it, it's all about, and it's Jimmy McGovern, so you know it's going to have all this stuff about Catholicism. But it essentially is about a crime that's been committed and redemption for it. And both of them are about, have this, the thing that runs through it for both characters, this idea that if you do something wrong, you'll be punished for it. So it's very sort of Catholic in that way. But it works really well as a storyline. That essentially you're not a bad person for having done something bad. like, or you might be, but in the instances of both characters, it's about sort of being put into, you know, it's about being sort of redeemed or having some kind of redemption for doing a bad thing. So essentially, yeah, neither character is a bad person. And
yeah, and I've seen stuff set in prisons. You know, there are. I haven't seen a lot of British prison stuff like ID and stuff like that. And I've kind of like generally put off that sort of stuff. But what did I watch the other day? Where Rush Hour. I saw Rush Hour, or I saw a bit of Rush Hour when they go into the prison to talk to Chris Penn. And they're like chatting to the prison guard who would be Stephen Graham in Time, and they're chatting to the prison guards, and it's all sort of like jokes going back and forth, and you know, and then they go into the prison, and it's sort of light, and you know, you go, ah, oh, it's prison, and then you see something that like Shawshank Redemption, where you kind of like go, it's sort of like this Hollywoodized, romanticized version of what prison. Yeah, it's awful, and there's kind of like, you know, shower rapes, and it's like, yeah, but it's like a romanticized oldie times. This is what the prison used to be like, and there was one guard that, you know, had like a good streak through. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of Hollywoodized, and so having watched loads of prison stuff, you kind of like have an idea of the way prison is represented. Either it's kind of like hell on earth, in kind of like, maybe not, I would say in kind of like an exaggerated way, or it's kind of like not as bad as you think it is. And when you see Time, it's like the first time I've really kind of considered being in that cell, being in prison, being surrounded by people that are that kind of mentally unhinged. And yeah, I kept saying out loud, fucking hell, prison looks shit. Mm. You know, it didn't feel like it was ratcheted up for like effects, and it didn't feel like it was sugar-coated for kind of like entertainment purposes. It's like, it looked hostile, it looked miserable, it looked boring, it looked shit. And I was just like, fucking hell, prison looked shit. And I it's really weird. It felt like a really refreshing way to portray it. Just like, yeah.
Yeah. I think that's sort of the power. And again, that thing about the, there's the bit, isn't there, where someone kind of confronts Stephen Graham's character, who is the kind of prison guard, and says, well, like, this prisoner shouldn't be in there because he's mentally ill. And he says, well, that's most of the people in there, but there's nowhere else for them to go. So it is kind of making a point about that as well. It feels like it's in that tradition of sort of British dramas as well, of being kind of like, sort of having a bit of a social responsibility, or trying to tell you something about the world of it, whilst also being like a real proper sort of drama that feels kind of like a, but it's almost like fable-like in its kind of idea of like crime and punishment, and what happens if you do something bad or something.
Really, if I've got one complaint, it would be that I thought that the last episode kind of, it all finished very neatly.
Mm.
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, I would say that I found that a little bit, it was a bit kind of like, I suppose you've got the first two episodes, I would say, are flawless, and then the third episode was kind of like, right, this is, you know, you get this problem with trilogies, you know, threes of anything. You've got the first one that sets up, the second one that doesn't have to finish it, and then the third one's got to sort of like wrap everything up. And the third one always sort of suffers a little bit from having that weight on its shoulders. But
I would agree with you, except for me, I really liked it because I wasn't expecting a neat ending, and I wasn't expecting it to be so like it felt sort of like it felt almost that, you know, the wheels were turning, but in a way, even though that is the natural ending, it feels almost like, because it's so grim. I mean, it's not like the ending isn't grim, but it's almost that you kind of constantly got that fear of something awful happening to everyone. That when it kind of wraps up in quite a neat way, you go, oh, right, that actually is the sort of, that is a satisfying ending. That isn't like something where I feel shortchanged. I felt like, actually, it's really pleasant to have something that is so, in a way, the proper ending that you would kind of hope for these characters.
Yeah, but you also see it sort of like, you know, it's a very slow burn character study where stuff is set up and it all pays off. And I guess it's kind of like life is full of random things. So to have stuff pay off so conveniently, kind of like at the end, is kind of like you go, yeah. Oh, yeah, I see. But you, but again, a lot of it could have been open-ended. I think, you know, the support cast were incredible. The guy that's always sort of like pushing him off the phone was like one of the most, in a non-obvious way, I've met people like him.
Yeah.
You go, you are an absolute cunt. And you are a hissable... A hissable villain, but not in kind of like a stereotypical way. I thought his prison, you know, his cellmate with the beard, and as soon as he showed up in the first episode, I was just like, that guy's acting is just absolutely incredible, you know? I loved it. When you compare it to something like Porridge, it's like, hey, they're cellmates, but they get, you know, it was just like, this looks shit.
Yeah. It really does. I was just going to say that the great thing about that guy who's like the sort of bully. I mean, bully seems like almost not strong enough a word for prison drama. But that guy, it's funny because he's cast by someone who in any other Sean Bean film would be someone Sean Bean had wiped the floor with. He's not a particularly physically impressive person. He's just a horrible bully. And he's using power, even though he himself is not a massive guy who you would think, oh, he's the guy who's...
You talk about the main bad guy.
Well, no, both of them really. The guy who's like the bully guy who's...
Yeah. But what they do is they show you early on, you know, you don't need to be physically imposing to, you know, it's, some of it's horrific and it makes you cry and it's just, but, you know, you come out of it and I don't know, I felt like a better person for watching it. I loved it. But let's do some fan mail for 40 seconds.
Okay,
and then
I should. It's a long one. I'll not get through this in. Right.
Well, you shouldn't have talked about the Magic Christian so much, to be honest, should you?
Right.
But you're in charge, mate. Okay. We're on your clock.
Dear Nick and Nat, really enjoyed you lads chatting about The Shining last week. The Shining was the first...
Well, hang on a minute. The guest isn't here yet, so there's no rush.
Okay.
Just need to say, who's reading the fan mail this week? Is it just you? We haven't got a special guest in to read the fan mail?
Who could it be?
I don't know. Who's there with you, Nat? Have some modicum of professionalism about yourself, Nat. It's radio. No one can see what's going on. Just imagine that they're there.
All right. Well, then, I've got with me... who can I do?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Really letting people in behind the wizard's curtain. really letting people in behind Devin Brown's curtain today, aren't you? The wizard.
Let's see if I can do... I'll see if I can get in touch with my old mate, Paul McCartney. Hey guys, how are you? I've got a new, have you heard my new album, McCartney 3? Yeah, I've been, pressed.
Oh my God.
I'm not sure that that's really you, Paul.
Hey, no,
What have the little kiddies written in and asked us this week? I must say, just as well that you're doing the fan mail, Paul, because I absolutely rejected peace and love. I reject all fan mail. This is a warning to all of you folks out there, you gals and boys out there, that if you send me any fan mail, I will kick off.
See, Natalie said, take your time, and then she's immediately said, the guest is here now.
Come on, read out one piece of fan mail. Right. I double dare you, Paul.
Dear Nick and Nat, really enjoyed you lads chatting about The Shining last week. The Shining was my first ever Stephen King book that I read and have been a big fan of it ever since. However, the book did leave me permanently scarred. I was about 14 years old at the time, and I just
did it land on your head?
I think that's what he's saying.
Confined to staying indoors for a few days with a plaster cast on my lower arm and hands, I was allowed to buy a book to read and keep my boredom at bay. I chose The Shining, perhaps based on nothing more than the cover, perhaps a lesson that you should always judge a book by its cover, but I digress. Reading a couple of chapters each night, as I was too frightened to go to sleep and needed a method of calming myself before I could nod off. Being 14, I'd recently discovered a new hobby, which usually left me and feeling suitably relaxed afterwards, so I thought I'd give it a try. That is where we're going, Nick. Being new to this pastime, I was only used to using my right hand, which was the hand now partially encased in plaster. I got that. However, the allure of my new leisure pursuit was so strong that I gave it a try, but alas, the abrasive surface of the plaster cast wore through my skin, leaving me with an aforementioned permanent scar. Have you either... Oh, God.
On his dick?
Have either of you had a permanent scar?
No wonder he's
embarrassing or otherwise. All the best, John. Oh, that John. You've let your side down, yeah? Put your side down with your story about The Shining and your rude nighttime pursuits. I mean, Paul's already left. He's a vegetarian. He doesn't want to hear this. Anyway, shall we get our guest on?
Oddly enough, I'm well off for this chat, but rules are rules. I reject all fan mail. Return to sender, peace and love.
Bless up.
I've of many permanent scars. None of them on my dick. Let's go.
If I had to do the same again.
Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back. We're back live. We're not live. We're pre-recorded. And I'm in my sister's bedroom. And Nathaniel is in his washroom. And we're joined now by Star Trek star Marina Sirtis. Hello. How are you doing?
I'm good. Hello. Hello. How are you?
Very well. Where are you? Where are you joining us from?
Twickenham.
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 Now, we were just playing the song, one of the songs we got you to choose, which was Fernando by ABBA. And this is Fan Club, and you like to ask people what they're a fan of. What made you choose Fernando?
I love ABBA. I love ABBA. It was, you know, it's very hard for me to choose a song, and because I love them, so many of them. But I chose Fernando because although I wasn't particularly fond of the second Mamma Mia movie,
here we go again.
It was worth the price of admission to see Cher sing Fernando to Andy Garcia. You haven't seen it, obviously. You're sitting there looking for it.
Well, I tell you, I saw the first film.
Yeah, the first film was great.
Yeah, I saw the first one. And my do you know what, actually? I'm back at my parents' house and I'm visiting my niece and she's 17 months old, and one of the only words that she can say at the moment is ABBA, because she's been brought up with ABBA music.
See, this is excellent parenting, you can tell your sister. Excellent.
No, I will, I will.
Yeah, I totally approve. Better than Black Sabbath, that's for sure.
Well, very different sides of the coin, aren't they?
My husband, God rest him, was a musician. And he wouldn't let me play ABBA in the house when he was home. And I was like, do you know what? When you write a hit song like Dancing Queen, then we'll talk, right?
Dancing Queen? That's my mum's favourite song.
That was voted the number one, you know, when that song goes on at a wedding or in a club, that's the song that everyone gets up and starts dancing. It's the number one dance song in the world.
Yeah.
I'm full of useless information.
No, I think that makes sense to me. I reckon.
And you've come to the right place. We're full of useless information. In terms of like albums and stuff, would you say that ABBA are famous for their albums or more for kind of like their greatest hits?
Their greatest hits. Well, the albums, like, I'm pretty sure the Gold album, which was the first one that had all their greatest hits, sold a gabillion copies all over the world. But no, they weren't known for their albums. Now, album-wise, David Bowie.
I'm the same. I'm with you.
David Bowie. All the way.
Have you got a favourite album of his?
Well, not one of the most popular ones, but Diamond Dogs is one of my favourite albums. That's I love Diamond Dogs. Some of the songs on Ziggy, The Man Who Fell to Earth. When I left England 35 years ago, I left for 3 months and was gone for 35 years, right? So when I left, I was living, when my dad died, my mum was in a terraced house in Haringey. And so I turned the top floor we turned it into two flats so that I could, you know, be with her. And I was talking to my brother recently and I said, mummy eventually went back to Greece. And I said to my brother, Steve, I said, you know what, Steve, the only thing that I'm really upset about was that I left all my albums when I went to America and they're gone, all my Beatles and Bowie and Stones and all, you know. And he went, no. I've got them. She took them to Greece and my brother's got them.
Oh, that's
so
nice.
I have all my old albums. I'm going to go in August if I can, and I'll probably bring them back with me. Although I don't have a record player. I'll have to buy a record player now.
But yeah. You can get a record player, right?
You
can get one. In fact, I have. Do you want to hear my David Bowie story?
Oh, yes, please.
Yeah.
All right. So back in the day, back in, you know, the dark ages when I was young, I went to every single David Bowie concert in and around London, right? And one of the first ones I went to was at the Rainbow in Finsbury Park.
Yeah, right, okay.
Right, remember? Right, okay.
Yeah.
So he had done Space Oddity. He'd gone away for a while, and this was like his comeback. So it was early 70s. And I took a friend of mine, Evros, a Greek guy, with me. And at the end of the... And I literally, everyone was just sitting there and going, oh, well done, well done, except me. And I'm going, I love you, David! You know, I'm the only one in the audience doing that. Anyway, at the end of the gig, the drummer came to the edge of the stage and he threw the drumstick at me. And Evros shoved me out the way and caught the drumstick. I went, give me the drumstick. He threw it at me. He goes, well, I caught it. I said, well, yeah, but he threw it at me. Anyway, never got the drumstick back. Cut to many years later, and I'm reading an article in Vanity Fair about David Bowie, and he says, back in the day before I met my wife, if I saw a girl I fancied in the audience, I'd have the drummer throw the drumstick at her.
Oh, man. What an opportunity missed.
That would have been a story, right?
Now, I know, of course.
Well, it's still a story.
Yeah, but it would have been a better story, and it would have been a notch. It would have been a notch, a very, very, very big notch on my belt.
Are you still in touch with your friend? Have you had a go at him since?
No. In fact, if I ever see him again, I'm going to rip his throat out with my teeth.
You could throw another drumstick at him. Do it hard.
Throw a brick at him.
So here's the thing, right? So Nathaniel is a huge David Bowie fan, right? And I have grown... I watched Labyrinth when I was little at the cinema, but I've never really got into him. So if I was trying to get into David Bowie, what do you recommend? How do I go about it? Where do I start?
Okay, I think you have to start with Ziggy Stardust. I think it's the most commercial. I'm just saying. There's a story. There's a through line in on the album. It's an actual story, and some of the songs are they're great. Also, it was a toss up between. I have to say, it was a toss up between Fernando and Suffragette City as what I was going to choose as my song, because he always played Suffragette City as his encore, because everyone just went bonkers. But I would start with Ziggy Stardust or maybe something earlier. But he was such a genius, and I'm getting a huge thrill now because my nephew in Greece literally picked up a guitar less than a year ago, and he's playing like Eddie Van Halen in like 11 months. And obviously he's got a gift. I said to him, so tell me who you like. Tell me. He's 16. He goes, I love David Bowie. And I was like, He's mine. He got some of my jeans. Yeah. Actually, I've got a great T-shirt that I bought on Venice Beach, and it says, I might be old, but I got to see all the cool bands.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But you do. That's already, even talking about ABBA and David Bowie, you kind of really... paints like a vivid picture of that kind of London you would have been growing up in.
Yes.
And just that time that... How old were you when you moved to America? So
32.
So at that time, tell us about that period, because now that feels... It's not uncommon now, is it, for British actors to go over there? But it felt like at that time, it felt like a much bigger thing. It felt further away as well, right?
Yes. America. It was me, Joni, and Emma Sam. Oh, it was me, Joni, Emma Sams, and Stephanie Beecham. We were the four. You know what? I just had it in my head that I had to go. I didn't know why. In fact, the year before I left, I didn't stop working. And then when I told my agent, stop submitting me for things, I'm going to LA. She was like, "But you've had your best year ever." And I went, "No, I've just got a feeling I have to go." And the rest is history, as they say.
So what had you been doing in England just before you went away?
Plays, TV, guest starring on other people's TV shows.
Because you were Ophelia in Hamlet, weren't you?
I was. That was my first job out of drama school, yeah. I went to Guildhall where... I was just talking about this last night, actually, because I'm a Cockney. I'm actually a real Cockney. I was born in the East End within the sound of the Bow Bells. And, of course, back in the day, so this was 1973, actors didn't speak with a Cockney. I mean, it's not like it is now. People, you had to learn how to speak like, not like the Queen, but, Vanessa Redgrave or something. And I spent 3 years at drama school. every lunchtime with a bone prop in my mouth, learning how to speak the Queen's English. And I remember I was in the lift with the director of drama, who was bemoaning the fact that none of his girls were going to get any work. The boys would be all right, but the girls, no, the girls are going to struggle. And I went, well, you don't have to worry about me. I've got a job. And he said, community theatre somewhere, darling. And I said, no, actually, I'm playing Ophelia. And obviously, it caught him by surprise. He went, you can't play Ophelia. And I went, well, you're the only effing person that thinks so. And I walked out. And I never went back. And I never got my certificate or anything. And I just thought, you know what? I've got a job. I don't need to get a certificate from drama school. And I left. And that was what I had a lot of. I had a lot of people telling me what I couldn't be and couldn't do. I actually had one teacher say to me, well, darling, if you want to be in Crossroads for the rest of your life. I mean, it was so... The class thing at drama school was so bad. But only Cockney was the accent that they wanted to get rid of. You could be Northern, you could be Scottish, you could be Irish. But if you're a Cockney, you're working class, pure and simple. There's no two ways about it. And they really, you couldn't be like that. But now you can. Now it's an asset to have an accent. So it's a full circle.
I suppose at that time there was probably just fewer examples of it as well, right? You just wouldn't have. I guess you would have, and I guess like Northern accents, you would have had those sort of films in the 60s and 70s, and you've got people like Albert Finney and people.
Yeah, but, and Tom Courtney and all those guys. Yeah.
The biggest Cockney.
Michael Caine. You know, Michael Caine was the only one who had a London accent.
And Dick Van Dyke.
Bless Michael Caine and Dick Van Dyke. Do you know, I worked with Dick Van Dyke.
It was
I did. I worked with Dick Van Dyke in his show Diagnosis Murder.
Great.
And it's the only time that I've been on a set and I've asked for someone's autograph, because my brother's favourite film was Chitty Chitty Bang Bang when he was a kid. And so I got Dick's autograph of my brother. But, you know, when you get to work with icons like that, it's such... Mm-hmm. Coming, you know, from North London, you never expect to be working with Dick Van Dyke or, you know, whoever. I was Prince Charles's official escort for one of our films that had a premiere in London for the Prince's Trust.
In actuality, you were Prince Charles's escort?
I was actually his date for the night. Yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah. So when he said to me, where are you from? And I said, Tottenham, sir. And he said, Tottenham. And I went, yeah, don't suppose you've ever been there unless you're opening a sports centre or something. Total verbal diarrhea. I was so nervous about being sat next to him.
Oof. But it shows that you like, despite that, you obviously had this huge kind of self-belief or belief in yourself that you could do it, and knowing that if you went to America... Like, presumably it was still nerve-wracking, right? Because, as I say, there wasn't these lots of examples of people that had already done it. So did it feel like a big risk?
I cried all the way. I literally cried all the way in the plane, because I got onto the plane and I just suddenly thought, what am I doing? I don't know anybody in America. I know one person who I'm going to be staying with. And no one else. And I just cried all the way. In fact, I cried so hard, I didn't even realise that I'd been upgraded to business class, because I've never been in business class. I didn't know what business class looked like. It's only when I, you know, did Star Trek and they had to fly me first class and business class that I went, oh, I was in business class on my way to Los Angeles the first time. And the airline attendant, bless her, took pity on me and came up, and she said about halfway through the flight, would you like to watch the captain fly the plane? And so this was before 9/11, obviously. So up I went into the cockpit, sat there watching them fly the plane, which is very boring, actually. And and I realised why. It wasn't because I was sobbing in, you know, 3C. It was because he fancied me, because he asked me out, right? So, anyway, the scones arrived, and I'm like, oh, scones. And I was gone like a rat out of an aqueduct when the scones arrived. I was like, my.
But one of your earlier roles was in Death Wish 3, right? Wasn't that filmed in America, or was that?
That was filmed here. It was filmed in Lambeth.
Right.
I'm feeling it they might Lambeth. All have been, in fact, yeah?
It was Lambeth pretending to be, you know, New York.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Wow. All right. Okay. Right.
Well, the other thing as well, talking of planes that you sort of, which is a sort of very iconic thing over here now, is the kind of Cinzano advert with Joan Collins and Leonard Rossiter.
Yeah, Leonard Rossiter, yeah.
I know. See, that was another highlight of my career. And, you know, and since that, I've got to know Joan because she was in one of the most famous episodes of the original show of Star Trek. And so I see her, you know, on the Star Trek, you know, go round. And we also had the same publicist for a while. And so, I've met her socially in LA. We're not mates or anything, but I have run into her socially. I've never mentioned that I'm the girl in the Cinzano ad.
Right. Oh, really?
Yeah, I've never told her that.
That seems like such a shame. It's such a
thing. That's like always the first thing that I say. I'm a comedian now, but I used to put out chairs in comedy stores. And so it's the first thing I say is like, oh, I used to put out chairs for you. Maybe that, yeah.
I don't know. You know, you never know how people are going to take things sometimes. So
sure.
Say anything.
So like in... So this is now 86, you were sort of 87?
86. End of 86, yeah.
This is when you go to America. So I would surprise, because as I say, and you said like Emma Sands, Joan Collins, yourself, I would have thought, was there not like a sort of expat community there? There wasn't a sort of idea that you were kind of friends with each other or would look each other up at all?
No, in fact, in my whole time in America, apart from the yearly BAFTA LA or Equity LA shindig around about Oscar time, I really didn't see, I didn't hang out with the Brits particularly. I had some English friends, but no, I wasn't in that Brit pack at all.
And so you're in America, was it just 3 months before Star Trek came along?
No, well, actually, I got my first job 5 days after I arrived.
Okay, that was a relief.
I'm the poster child of what isn't supposed to happen when a British actress goes to Hollywood. You're supposed to struggle, you know, and all that, and wait tables. I've never waited a table in my life. I always worked retail, actually. I'm very good at folding jumpers. But, yeah, I got a job in 5 days. And this is the difference between England and America. I had saved up for a year to go to America for 3 months. And with one job, I earned as much as it had taken me a year to save in England, and I could stay for another 3 months. And at the end of that 3 months is when I got Star Trek.
Wow. What was that first job?
It was a show called Hunter with an ex-football player called Fred Dreyer, who was a policeman in it. And I played an Aussie, and I went into the audition, and they were like, oh, like, good day. Good day, Blue. And they were like, is that an authentic Australian accent? And I went, oh, yes. Yes. I'm of Greek heritage. Did you not know that the largest Greek community outside of Athens is in Melbourne? I lived there for 7 years. All lies. Lies, lies, lies. And I got the job, and then I went on the set, and there were real Australians. And then, you know, you start bricking it because you're like, oh, my God. I'm right about that. But so that was my first job. And then I did another couple of jobs, and then Star Trek came along. So it was, you know.
So I read somewhere that you auditioned, that you auditioned 6 times.
Yes. Thank you for doing your homework.
Oh, I'm very excited to have you on.
No, thank you for doing your homework. You know, I was telling Alice that I have walked out of interviews. I have, because I'm a bullshit cow. I've walked out of interviews when they say to me 20 years later or 30 years later, as it is now, how did you get the job? Describe your character. And I just go, do your bloody homework. And I walk up and I go out and I leave. So that's why I had to mention, thank you for doing your homework.
Well, we were going to see how long we could go without mentioning Star Trek.
Oh, okay. Well, you know what? I've just taken up 30 years of my life, which is kind of half my life. That's really hard not to do.
And so when you've got the job now. Oh, sorry, were you going
to
say something else?
You've got to audition six times to get the job. So talk us through how that process was as a young actress in America.
It was an audition a week. And obviously, the more you go in, you know, you're getting closer and closer. You know, it's not rocket science. And at the last audition, which is called the test, you have to sign your contract before you walk in the room, because they're very clever. They don't want to offer you the job and then negotiate. They negotiate before you get offered the job, because you'll sign your firstborn away before you get offered the job. Do you know what I mean? It's like you'll sign anything. And my agent was saying, oh, I got you a great deal. And then I discovered I had the worst deal in Hollywood.
Right.
Worst deal in Hollywood. But for me, you know, coming from England, it was telephone numbers. I'd never earned that kind of money before. But it wasn't a good deal. Everyone else was earning more than me, probably throughout the show. But again, you know what? So what? It's I loved it. I loved the people. I loved the part. I loved, you know, it was brilliant. It was actually brilliant. So, yeah, the fact that, mainly the boys is still a thing. The boys earn more than the girls.
Mm. And at that time, like, Star Trek was already like a huge phenomenon. So did it feel like this show's going to run and run? Did you feel like when you signed?
No, we thought, we'll go for a year and then we'll get cancelled. But even if we'd only gone for a year, that was going to be the longest job I'd ever had in television. So, you know, all the rest was a bonus. But, yeah, it was and actually people forget now, because everyone's so excited to see a new Star Trek show when it comes out. When we came along, they were like, how dare you? How dare you think you can take the place of my Spock and my Kirk? You know, you know, and literally I'd go to conventions and there'd be like 30 people there scowling at me.
But they were still in the cinemas, weren't they? They were still making
making the features,
the features at the time. So it must have been kind of, quite jarring for audiences. This is just me thinking out loud.
Okay.
But that was it, right? Because that was happening at the same time. And so was it like every year you were thinking, are we going to get another year? It
didn't feel pretty much do. No, you pretty... I mean, when you sign your contract, you sign for 6 years in the States. So once you've done 6 years, then you renegotiate, you know, for any extra years, like we did an extra year. We pretty much knew after the third season that we were a hit. Mind you, it wasn't until the third season that I applied for my green card, because they have to re-advertise your job.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they have to re-advertise your job and they actually have to audition people.
Oh, for your part?
For my part, yeah.
So are you re-auditioning or have you...
No, they basically put an ad in the trade saying, wanted Greek-British actress with hazel eyes, 5 foot, I mean, describe me, like, perfectly, and then hope that, you know, no one applies. But they did, and then they have to audition them. It's a formality, but I was so insecure that I was just too nervous to even put them to the test until the third season.
Of course. But I mean, so initially when you're auditioning, you're not auditioning with a whole bunch of Greek British female actresses.
No,
are you?
No. It was a bunch of.
But now they're specifically trying to replace you.
Yeah, when they're doing this for immigration, basically, there are rules. You know, you have to prove that no other American can play this part before they give it to a foreigner.
Oh, wow.
Before you get your green card, you have to prove that you're unique and special.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And I didn't feel that unique and special for the longest time.
No, but that's...
So
it's a kind of awful thing for you, though, because it must just seem so kind of... You've got this part, and it feels like, even though it's a formality and you know, you can look back at it and go, oh, I was always going to do it. It sort of... I guess it must undermine the confidence a bit, right?
Well, it does. oh my goodness, what if someone walks in and they're really brilliant, you know, and they're better than me, you know, it might be on the next plane home.
But I guess from the description, also... they want you, don't they? They still want you to do it. Yeah. That's you're the character.
Yeah, and now looking back, of course, I'm like, well, you know, there was no reason for me to, well, there actually were a few reasons for me to be that insecure, but, it, you know, they were mainly in my head and not in reality.
Would you say that it's sort of like in their interest to make you not feel special so that can get better deals out of you?
Absolutely. It's divide and rule over there. Yeah. It's divide and rule. In fact, they hated the fact that as a cast, we loved each other.
Right, yeah.
I just watched the Friends reunion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I just started watching it, and Gates called me, the lady who played Dr. Crusher, and she called me and she said, what are you doing? I said, I'm just about to start watching the Friends reunion. And she said, oh, I haven't watched it yet. And I said, well, they have just experienced for the first time what we've experienced 100 times. And she said, what's that? I said, as a group, they've walked out in front of an audience who's gone bananas because they're all together.
Yeah.
And I said, and it blew their minds. You could see they were so, wow, this is amazing. We do that every weekend at conventions, right? We walk out and we're the Beatles. We walk out and we're the Beatles, right? And I said, yeah. And they said, they're talking about the chemistry and how we had such great chemistry and, you know, we just got on so well. And then they said, this is only the second time in 17 years we've all been in a room together. And I'm like, well, how good friends are you then? Because, you know, we're in rooms together all the time, my cast. We go out to lunch, we go out to dinner, we have parties, we always get together at Christmas. You know, we are proper friends, not just in the title of the piece.
That was the impression I always got, especially when, because that was the point when the sort of original crew of the Enterprise, they sort of stopped doing it. That was, I guess, it wasn't a given, but then you all took over the movies too. So you essentially became Star Trek, right? You became...
Well, we are now, I mean, listen, the original cast is the original cast. You know, they are icons now, absolutely. But we were the most successful show.
Hmm.
So we've become like the flagship show for the franchise. They call us the legacy actors now. Instead of the old farts, we're called the legacy actors.
In a way, because Star Trek, the original Star Trek lasted, what, 3 seasons?
And yeah, then it came
back as a film series.
Yeah.
But with Next Generation, off of Next Generation came stuff like Deep Space Nine and Voyager. And with Next Generation, it was like the blueprint of how you... Because the original films came out like a decade after the series started.
That's right, that's right.
And your film sort of like came out almost...
Right after. I had a day off in between finishing the series and starting on the first film, yeah.
And it's sort of like, so you kind of like made, your crew made the blueprint of how you actually make this into like a long, an ongoing franchise.
Yeah, but it kind of, it didn't, because we were so successful, that blueprint hasn't really worked for any of the shows that came after us because they didn't have the audience to make films, you know, to go into the features.
Of course, so,
yeah.
But I guess it's been ongoing since. It's never stopped since.
We'll never
stop. Which is, it's now just...
We'll never stop. It's like, you know, I don't know. I think some of the original cast, no names, were a bit upset when we came along. But look, as someone who's, you know, been like at the forefront of the resuscitation, if you like, every product, every show that comes after us is great for everybody because it gives the whole franchise a lift when there's a new show and we all benefit.
And you've been in all of them, haven't you? You've been in the 4 Next Generation films and you've been in the 4 series.
I wasn't in DS9, but I was in Voyager and Enterprise and Picard now, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Dorn is the one who's been in everything. Michael Dorn was in one of the original movies. He was in
Star Trek 6, yeah.
He was in 6 and he was in DS9. I don't think he was in the other TV shows, but, you know.
And you've done a voice in Lower Decks as well, though.
Yes, which I haven't seen, I have to say, so don't ask me any questions about it.
I won't ask it. But speaking of that, you were also in an episode of The Orville, correct?
I was. Well, Seth, he's a huge fan. He's a huge fan. I mean, The Orville is really an homage to TNG.
And what are some of the differences? What are some of the differences between being on an Orville set and being on a Star Trek set?
Seth MacFarlane is the difference. Seth MacFarlane, who literally is a bit of a control freak, and I know he wouldn't mind me saying that because it's true. But he controls every aspect of that show, from costumes to editing to directing. I mean. I was doing one of my scenes and he sits in Video Village, you know, watching us on his little, you know, screen. And I did a scene and, you know, waiting and to get for him or the director to come, Jonathan directing, for him to come in and give me some notes. And I hear this voice and I look around and there's an amplifier on the set and it's Seth speaking into a microphone in Video Village, giving me instructions on the set. And I was like, is that you, Lord? Are you Lord? It was just, oh, well, got Marina. All right, yeah. Got to remember, she's nothing like Councillor Troy.
And you spoke about that you're all kind of great friends. And that always, I always got that impression when the movies were coming out as well, because weren't you all kind of sort of tied together and then you sort of had the deals that everyone was kind of looking out for each other and making sure everyone really was getting, fair treatment.
We're very, I mean, listen, it's Hollywood. The people with the most words get the most money. That's how it works, right? Mm-hmm. I'm a very pragmatic person. I know exactly where I am on the Star Trek totem pole. I know exactly where I am on that, you know, ladder, if you like. And so I don't get upset about things. I don't say, well, why is so-and-so getting that and I'm not getting it? It's because so-and-so might be more popular than you, Marina, you know, whatever. So, I think if you're not pragmatic, and a lot of actors aren't pragmatic, but if you're not pragmatic about what your position is in the scheme of things, you're just going to be a very unhappy person and very dissatisfied and very bitter. And that's just rubbish. You don't need to live your life like that.
Now, Marina.
I've met Alice Cooper. I've just saw a T-shirt. I've met Alice Cooper as well. He does conventions, you know. He does autograph shows.
And he's Freddy Krueger's dad as well, so he must go to lots of... He was Freddy Krueger's dad, so he must be at all sorts of conventions. I love him. He's my favourite. So we sort of need to wrap up with you.
We've got five more minutes.
We've got to play a game with you. But in three words, sum up what it is that you love about Steel Magnolias.
Shirley MacLaine.
I think that might count as six, but we'll let it okay.
In three words, perfect chick flick.
Hey, that's great. Right, I've never seen Steel Magnolias, but it's always been on my list.
I'm going to tell you, there's a line in the movie, and it's really sad that I know this. There's a line in the movie where Dolly Parton says, "Laughter through tears is my favourite emotion," right? And that is Steel Magnolias. You are laughing and crying at the same time.
Yeah, it's got an amazing cast. I forgot Dolly Parton was even in it, actually.
Yeah.
Great. I'm going to hand you over to Nathaniel now, and we are going to play an international name, an internationally famous game, Better or Worse. Nathaniel, take over.
Now, Marina, this is Better or Worse, and you just have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person before, based on my opinion, to score points. And I've done it with musicians this week. Okay. So it's going to begin with Freddie Mercury. But I think Tina Turner is better or worse than Freddie Mercury, based on my opinion?
Worse.
Better.
Better?
Better for me. This is it.
Sorry.
David Bowie, better or worse than Tina Turner?
Better.
David Bowie's better from our previous conversation.
Mick Jagger, better or worse than David Bowie?
Worse.
Worse. Bob Dylan, better or worse than Mick Jagger?
Better.
I would say better.
Better.
That's how I learned to play guitar, you know. I taught myself to play guitar playing Bob Dylan songs. It's only got three chords in every song.
That's how you do it. Bill Collins, better or worse than Bob Dylan?
Who?
Bill Collins.
Oh, worse.
Worse.
Elvis Presley, better or worse than Phil Collins?
Better.
Well, I was never an Elvis fan, so...
What would I say?
Better.
Cliff Richard, the British Elvis, better or worse than, better or worse than Elvis?
Well, I think he's better, but you're going to say worse.
I am going to say worse. Jimi Hendrix, better or worse than Cliff Richard?
Better.
Better.
Better. Elton John, better or worse than Jimi Hendrix?
You're very serious.
Ooh, hang on. Elton and Jimmy. Well, I'd have... Oh, that's a hard one.
You're
going to say worse than Jimmy.
Worse. Here's what I'm going to say. Prince, better or worse than Elton?
Better.
Better.
Better. It's quite a good score, though, I think you've got.
Nine! You've got 9 out of 10. I don't know who else. I can't remember what the ranking is.
You know what it is? It's because I'm an empath.
That's exactly what it is.
It's like, I always used to watch the shows and go, why am I in the poker game? Why is Troy in the poker game? She's an empath. Poker is all about knowing when people are bluffing.
What would be good is if it just cut to you scooping up all the money at the end.
Exactly. Oh, no. It's a switch. I can turn it on and off. It's off. Honestly, it's off. And then, you know, I'd wait until there's a really big pot and then I'd, you know, just clean up.
And we've come to the end of our time with you, but thank you so much for joining us.
This has been a lot of fun.
Oh, well, you're welcome back anytime if you ever want to come back.
I will come back.
Oh, great. Brilliant. We love having you on. That's the end of the show. Thank you, everyone, for listening. That's goodbye from me.
Goodbye. From me.
That's goodbye from Nat. He's just said that while I was saying that as well. And Marina Curtis is gone. So we're going to wrap up. Goodbye. Look after yourselves. Look after each other. And we're nearly out of the woods, maybe, and until we're locked up again in September. So have a nice day.
Teardrops for one heart to carry on.